Hello and welcome to Spotlight. Israel keeps pounding the Gaza Strip for a fourth straight day, and the death toll from Israel's strikes on the besieged Palestinian territory continues to rise. According to the health ministry, so far more than 30 Palestinians, including women and children, have lost their lives, and scores of others have been injured. Palestinian resistance groups have responded to the aggression by firing rockets into Israeli-occupied territories. The latest round of escalation was triggered by Israeli forces' assassination of four Islamic Jihad leaders on Tuesday. How far should the Israeli violence go for the international community to intervene and put an end to the crimes being committed against the Palestinian people? Joining us on Spotlight, we have Firas El-Najem, manager of Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, joining us from Toronto. And also international coordinator at the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, is joining us from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program. To the both of you, let's start off with Mr. El-Najem in Toronto. How do you view the recent wave of Israeli violence and aggression against the Gaza Strip?
Yes. First, I would like to send condolences to the families of the martyrs and salute to the resistance in Palestine. This is a way for the Zionist regime and the Netanyahu administration to deflect from the real problems that they're having internally. And divert the problem somewhere else. So he's really caught up in a lot of internal issues and problems within his own regime and his own people, his people, the settlers over there, and so on. And this is a way, kind of, just to run away from the problems. And he's also at the same time, they are testing the Palestinian resistance and the unity of the Palestinian resistance, because they've mostly targeted the Islamic Jihad movement. They really haven't targeted the Hamas movement. So maybe they're trying to also cause a division between the Islamic Jihad and Hamas, because when they target the Islamic Jihad leadership, Hamas obviously should take it as if they're targeting their own leadership, because they are all united against the Zionist regime. So this is also another thing, is to test the unity of the resistance and the strength of the resistance inside Palestine. At the same time, they're also testing the international community and to see what their responses are, because they're probably preparing for more atrocities and more intense battles with the Palestinian factions. They're very upset that Gaza is a liberated, blockaded area. I mean, we got to be honest with ourselves. Palestine overall is occupied, except Gaza. Gaza is a liberated land that's just blockaded, pretty much. You know what I mean? So it's occupied from outside, not from inside. The Zionists can't just enter inside Gaza. So this is a very big model, I think, that could be also implemented in different areas in Palestine. Hopefully, it could be transferred to the West Bank, to Haifa, different areas where the people will unite and push the Zionists and the IDF out of their areas and kind of build their own infrastructures and then kind of rely on, the axis of resistance. And that is obviously the Islamic Republic of Iran and the other factions that are allied with them, because that is the main infrastructure and main establishment that is supporting all these resistant movements.
Right.
So I think the Zionist regime is in a very, very weak spot right now. And we can see the missiles flying over from Gaza into Tel Aviv, into different cities. It's showing how weak the Zionist regime and how weak the settlers are as well.
Charlotte Cates, what are the goals and objectives for the Israeli regime right now? The Israelis are obviously known for seeking instability across the region and with countries surrounding it.
I think there are several objectives that they're trying to pursue. Like your other guest said, one of those objectives is to externalize the ongoing crisis and contradictions within the Zionist regime by creating a unified front around the bombing and killing of Palestinians and the occupation of further Palestinian land. And this has always been the point of unity of the Zionist forces, whether they call themselves liberal or they are openly fascist, like Ben-Gvir, Netanyahu, and his cohort, has always been the targeting of Palestinians. Another objective, quite clearly, is pursuing this ongoing policy of assassination. Now, of course, the policy of assassination is nothing new. This is something that the Zionist movement has and the Israeli state have continuously pursued. We've seen it in the 1970s, in the 1980s, in the early 2000s. We've seen it time and time again, and we're seeing it now, where there's an attempt to target some of the most effective leaders of the Palestinian resistance in an attempt to wipe out the length of experience that they have accumulated. However, at the same time, I think it's also clear that the resistance has established a balance of power and a framework of deterrence to actually stop these kinds of Zionist attacks. And what they're trying to do is reset the framework to an era before Gaza had developed this strong resistance, and they will not be able to do so. And that's very obvious in the response that we have seen continuously from the Palestinian people and the resistance, despite these horrific attacks.
Firas Al-Najm, staying on this issue of the assassination of leaders of the resistance of the Palestinian factions, Hezbollah leader Seyed Hassan Nasrallah earlier today said that the Israeli killing of resistance leaders, and add to that women and children, will lead to an all-out conflict. Iran's foreign minister believes that this shows Israel's desperation and vulnerability in the face of Palestinian resistance. Elaborate on those comments for us, please.
Yes. I mean, they are trying to target the strength of the resistance, and obviously that is the leadership, right? And they know that the resistance now and the leadership is very unified, and this is all throughout Palestine. I mean, if we look at the history and track of what happened was after Sheikh Adnan Qadr Adnan, when he died, and he's part of the Islamic Jihad, when he died while he was in incarceration and he did a hunger strike and he died, and then the retaliation came from Gaza. I mean, so it shows that the resistance in all of different areas in Palestine is unified and they feel for each other. And this is a very beautiful development, actually, for the resistance, that anywhere you attack a Palestinian faction, the other groups in different cities will make sure that they avenge and they teach a lesson to the Zionist regime. And this is how it is now. The unification is what's really hurting the Zionists. And they're actually in the opposite. They're disunited now, and you can see the streets of the illegitimate state of Israel is that it's full of people protesting. Well, now because of this recent escalation with the Gaza, it kind of maybe pushed the people away from protesting. And this is probably exactly what the Zionist regime wanted. They wanted people to focus on a war with the Palestinians and to have their rage and anger and hatred towards the Palestinians. And he's just deflecting, and this is only temporary. It's going to come back at him, Netanyahu, and it's going to burn his hands. I think he's going to be burned very bad for what he's doing by his own people, I think. I don't even think it has to be done by the Palestinians because there's a lot of dissatisfaction and there's a lot of disunity and there's a lot of problems internally in the Zionist regime, this rotten regime.
Charlotte Cates, our guest in Toronto earlier mentioned the issue of the unity of the different Palestinian factions. We can see now that all Palestinian resistance factions are uniting in the face of Israel's aggression. Are the Israelis worried about a United Palestinian Resistance Front, all groups and all parties uniting against the occupation?
It's very clear that particularly since the Battle of Saif al-Quds, or the Unity Intifada, 2 years ago in May 2021, this concern about the unity not only between the organizations of the resistance, but also between the Palestinian people throughout all the areas of Palestine, from the river to the sea, and with Palestinians in exile and diaspora, and with regional forces, Arab forces, and international forces for the liberation of Palestine, has been a major concern for the occupation forces. We saw this once again last year in August 2022 in the Battle of the Unity of the Fronts, and that this has become an increasingly heard slogan in the resistance movement in the past year that has come. So obviously, this is something that is a strong weapon for the Palestinian people. What's happened in the past 30 years is that the unity of the Palestinian people has been disrupted and undermined by the so-called peace process, by attempting to liquidate the Palestinian cause, by tearing off segments of the Palestinian people, or creating a so-called Palestinian Authority in the West Bank to serve as a security force for the occupation and not for defense for the Palestinian people. And what the resistance has done, on the contrary, is actually to restore a real national unity and unified framework to confront occupation and fight for liberation. And so this is something that the occupation wants to target. This is why they make these statements about, oh, we're only targeting Islamic Jihad, or we're only targeting this force or this faction. The purpose of this is to attempt to break apart the unity of the resistance that exists, and yet that we continue to see from the joint operations room of the resistance, making it clear that that unity has not been disrupted or divided. But we can see that this has always been a goal of the Zionist project, is to disrupt and dismantle Palestinian unity. And it's clear that these leaders that are targeted for assassination are not only leaders of one party or force or faction, although they are distinguished in that role. They are leaders of the Palestinian resistance, and they are leaders of a resistance movement that is really providing a different vision for humanity around the world, that it's possible to resist imperialism, colonialism, and Zionism despite the balance of technological power that the occupation continues to hold because of its, you know, billions of dollars in U.S. weaponry that it receives every year.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Right. Firas Anajim, let's go back to the issue of the Palestinian resistance response to the latest Israeli aggression, the intensified Palestinian rocket attacks in response to the Israeli aggression at the Israeli targets have, by many accounts, exposed weaknesses of the regime's much-touted anti-missile systems. Will the growing Palestinian military capabilities pose a major challenge for Tel Aviv now? In other words, should the Israelis start to feel less secure now?
Yes, I mean, it's very obvious. Like, we've seen the rockets, a good portion of them landed in Tel Aviv and Sidrot and all these different cities. And the sirens were very loud everywhere, and people were hiding in different areas, and they see missiles hit different areas. The resistance is getting more experience, more strength, and They're advancing with their weaponry as well, because they have assistance from the Islamic Republic of Iran and from, the Hezbollah and from, the Popular Mobilization Forces in Iraq. I mean, all the ones that fought, against the colonial powers, against, terrorist groups such as ISIS and so on. They've learned a lot of experience, and they're also assisting each other and supporting each other in different ways, logistically, information-wise, technology, different ways, right? And the Palestinian factions are getting stronger and stronger, right? And it's not just them. I mean, even the young children, the sons and daughters of these leaders that were assassinated, you can see the way they spoke was so bold, with so much belief and bravery, and they have so much certainty that they will be the generation of liberation. I mean, this is the slogan that we're going to be using, because we have an annual walk against Israel, as the Zionists here celebrate 75 years of occupation every year. They celebrate and they walk with Israel, so they go in thousands and they do a marathon, unfortunately, in the name of Israel, the state of Israel. Our slogan is, we are the generation of liberation. And tomorrow and this weekend will be marking the Nakba, the catastrophic event of stealing Palestine and occupying Palestine. And I think all over Canada, all over the States, all over the West, there's massive amounts of rallies that are happening, and it's growing more and more everywhere in the world. And people are paying more attention to the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian suffering. And we're going to continue to raise the flag of Palestine and call for a free Palestine and for the liberation of the Holy Land of Palestine. And the thing about it is, the Jewish people also come. Like, rabbis from New York are coming to our protest. Rabbis from Montreal are coming to our protest. And they're against Israel. They're against the Zionist regime. Just like Muslims are against ISIS and against Daesh. I mean, it's the same thing. You know, it's a kidnapping. It's a hijacking of a holy name, holy religion. And used for an evil project, a colonial project, a settler project, a terrorist organization, a terrorist regime such as Israel. And it's very near. We can see that it's getting weaker and weaker, and hopefully that we will see liberation in our generation.
Charlie Cates, Said Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah said that despite continuation of aggression against Gaza, the battle of resistance has not stopped. Many analysts also say that resistance is the most viable option left for Palestinians. Do you see it in that light as well? How important is this consistent resistance?
Palestinian resistance has continued since the beginning of colonialism and occupation in Palestine, and it's continuing today. And it's clear that just as, as was stated, 50 years ago, that resistance is the strategic choice and the path forward for the Palestinian movement, because it's the resistance that's defending the people and the land of Palestine from the river to the sea, and providing a real mechanism of meaningful pressure and accountability on the occupation, which is not being done by any international force or body. Instead, the Western powers are lining up. Now they suddenly are concerned about achieving a ceasefire in Gaza because they are seeing a response from the resistance. And so it's clear that the resistance is a strategic choice and a path forward for the Palestinian people. This is as the guest from Toronto said, this is also marking the 75th commemoration of al-Nakba. There are going to be people around the world marching in the streets this weekend and in the coming days, not just to commemorate 75 years of genocide and 75 years of attacks and 75 years of dispossession, but also to celebrate 75 years of resistance for liberation and return. And right now it is the resistance on the front lines throughout occupied Palestine, in Gaza, in the West Bank, fighting back, fighting against the occupier, and showing that it is possible to strike a real blow against these forces despite their backing by the most powerful imperialist forces in the world. That when we go out and march for Palestine this weekend, we are marching in solidarity with the Palestinian people and their resistance for liberation and return.
For us, Najim, one of the most alarming aspects of all of this is the Israeli impunity. Hamas said the silence of the international community emboldens Israel to continue its aggression. Earlier today, Hezbollah's Hassan Nasrallah said the world turning a blind eye to the Israeli killing of women and children is alarming. How do the Israelis get away with these crimes, and how can this status quo change?
They get away with it because of the Zionist lobbies and, you know, their rich Zionists that support certain politicians and, you know, a way to bully them and blackmail them and bribe them and things like this. This is what they've been doing for many, many years, manipulating things, controlling media slowly, controlling a lot of different important, you know, dimensions of the system in Canada and the States, everywhere. And the United Nations is silent. You know, they're crying about Ukraine, a one-year-old conflict, but then 75 years of occupation. You know, there's no equality. You know, and there's selectivity based on human rights of who they care about, who is worthy of a human and who's not worthy of a human. The Palestinians, for them, are not even human because they don't even... When have they ever imposed sanctions against Israel? When have they ever called for the ICC, the International Criminal Court, to investigate or to hold Netanyahu and his cabinet responsible for all the crimes they've committed, killing Shireen Abu Akla, a very important American Palestinian journalist, not too long ago. We're just marking the one-year anniversary of that. A young lady that was working so hard to cover the atrocities and the attacks by the Israelis, and she was doing her basic job, and she was shot right in the neck. You know what I mean? And then they also attacked her coffin. I mean, this is, shows you that the Palestinians cannot rely on the United Nations. They cannot rely on these Western governments. They have to rely on their unity and their resistance. And that's it. That's the only way it works. Because if they see that there was hope, they've tried it before. They've seen what Arafat has made agreements before. Mahmoud Abbas has made agreements and bowed down and humiliated himself and his Palestinian people. And they didn't get nothing in return. They got nothing. Well, what did they get? The West Bank is violated every day. They shoot people. They attack houses. They bombard. They blockade. They make their lives miserable. They keep them in insecurity. And what is Mahmoud Abbas? What has he accomplished? Nothing. The only people that have accomplished something are the resistance and the unity of the resistance. Okay. And let's hope that it keeps growing and stronger and stronger.
Let's get a final thought in from Charlotte Cates. Has a lack of action over the years from international bodies such as the UN, the EU, the OIC, most notably from Arab governments, contributed to the status quo?
Well, of course it has. And this is, you know, largely due to the involvement and the direction provided by the United States, Britain, the European powers, Canada, essentially the imperialist forces that have sought to maintain the Zionist project in the region as their kind of military base to disrupt the region and maintain hegemony and control over people's destiny, future, and resources. And it's the Palestinian resistance and their allies in the Lebanese resistance and all the forces of the resistance in the region and around the world that are actually standing up on the front lines to confront that imperialism and create a better future for all of us everywhere in the world.
All right, thanks a lot. Manager of Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, joining us from Toronto, and also International Coordinator at Samdoun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, joining us from Vancouver. Thanks for contributing to the program, and also a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll try to have a look at the commentary of Chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode. Dear listeners, now let's listen to 224th up to the ending verses of Chapter Shu'ara.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَالشُّعَرَاءُ يَتَّبِعُهُمُ الْغَاوُونَ
And the poets, only the deviators follow them.
أَلَمْ تَرَ أَنَّهُمْ فِي كُلِّ وَادٍ يَهِيمُونَ
Do you not see that in every valley they roam?
وَأَنَّهُمْ يَقُولُونَ مَا لَا يَفْعَلُونَ
And that they say what they do not do.
إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ وَذَكَرُوا اللَّهَ كَثِيرًا وَانْتَصَرُوا مِنْ بَعْدِ مَا ظُلِمُوا وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلَبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ
Except those poets who believe and do righteous deeds, and remember Allah often, and defend the Muslims after they were wronged. And those who have wronged are going to know to what kind of return they will be returned.
These couple of words were discussing the poets. And actually, the name of this very chapter is taken from this very verse, 224th one, where the name of poets is mentioned. وَالشُعَرَاء يَتَّبِعُهُمُ الْغَاوُونَ In the previous episodes, we understood that there are three qualities mentioned for these aimless poets. The first is that their followers are misguided people. The second quality is that they are aimless people and they change whenever their doctrine changes pretty soon. And they do not act according to their understandings and their sayings. Yet, in view of the fact that there are some pure and purposeful poets who do based on the truth, and they say the truth, they actually drag their adherents to the path of purity and truthfulness. Though they were scarcely found of this kind of poets in that society, so we must know that the Holy Quran separates them from others with an exception. So that's why the Holy Quran says, إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ Except those who believe and do righteous deeds.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
فَبَدَا وَضِيئًا كَالنُّجُومِ تَأَلُّقًا وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly, the Jews.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So, in order that the right of these faithful artists and truthful strivers would not be wasted, the Holy Quran separates these poets, aimless poets, from the others with an exception. Except those who believe and do righteous deeds. إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ. Those poets whose aim is not merely saying poems, but in their poems they follow some godly and humane aims. Those poets who do not dive only in their poetry and do not neglect Allah, but they remember Him much and their poetry reminds people of Allah. Those are exceptions. The verse continues saying, and remember Allah much, وَذَكَرُوا اللَّهَ كَثِيرًا. When such poets are unjustly treated with, they use their own intellectual intuition for defending both themselves and the believers. So the verse says, and defend themselves after being wronged. If they somehow vilify a group by their poems, it is because they want to defend the truth for this tax against their poems. So, there have been stated four qualities for the poets who have aims. Having faith, إِلَّا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا, doing righteous deeds, وَعَمِلُوا الصَّالِحَاتِ, وَذَكَرُوا اللَّهَ كَثِيرًا, they remember Allah much, وَانْتَصَرُوا مِنْ بَعْدِ مَا ظُلِمُوا, and they stand severely against oppression and from the power of poetry for repelling it. That's how they use poetry. Since most of the verses of this surah contain consolation to both Prophet and the scantly believers of that day in the face of the enemies, and since many verses of this surah have been revealed to defend the Prophet ﷺ against the enemies' undue accusations, the surah has been concluded with an expressive sentence unto those obstinate enemies. We shall continue with the last verse in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
With reporters.
Pakistan's Supreme Court has ruled that the arrest of the former Prime Minister Imran Khan was illegal, ordering his immediate release and asking the government to ensure his security. The court also urged the ex-premier to condemn the violent protests and emphasized that court's primary responsibility is to protect the citizens of the country. The country's top judge in his short verdict said that Khan would be kept in the police headquarters till his next appearance before the High Court on Friday over safety concerns. Khan was arrested by Pakistan's security forces on Tuesday over corruption allegations. The ruling Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz has criticized the country's Supreme Court for setting Imran Khan free, calling him a criminal.
The Supreme Court has double standards toward the government and Imran Khan. It has ruled that Khan, who is accused of corruption, should be provided with all facilities and be able to meet people freely. It would send a message that the courts are willing to compromise on justice. My only question is why the court has double standard.
The angry supporters of Imran Khan welcomed the Supreme Court decision, saying the release of their leader actually upholds the rule of law in the country.
Supreme Court of Pakistan ka shukr ada.
We are thankful to the Supreme Court for releasing Imran Khan from illegal detention by the government. The recent verdict of the top court will be considered as the supremacy of the rule of law in the country, which was violated by the current regime.
After being released by the court, the former PM expressed his grievances about his arrest, stating that he was abducted illegally and tortured during custody. Khan urged followers of his party to end their protests and refrain from damaging public and private property. Pakistan remains in the grip of deadly violence and protests after the arrest of the ex-premier.
Although the former Pakistani premier can now breathe a sigh of relief following the top court's decision, experts believe that Imran Khan has to prepare himself for more political challenges in coming days. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The fourth Tehran International Book Fair has opened in the Iranian capital. Some 2,700 domestic publishers and 100 foreign publishers from over 40 countries have attended this fair this year. The motto of this year's book fair is "The future is worth reading." The international section of the fair aims to introduce the capacities of the publishing industry of the Islamic Republic of Iran to expand cultural exchanges in the international scene to lay the groundwork for communication between Iranian and foreign publishers. For the first time, bookstore owners can participate in the exhibition, and 200 have registered to compete with publishers in the virtual exhibition.
As you know, that Tahran Book Fair, one of the most important book fairs, that's Oman, Sultanate of Oman, that's need that should be that participate. You know, as you know, that's more that's visit to the book fair. And as you know, that's one of the most important, that's to participate the relationship between Oman and Iran, that's most important and large. So that's from many years, that's about the relations.
For the second time, a virtual exhibition has also been launched to make books available to book enthusiasts. As usual, the books are available to the public at a discount. The rate of discount is 10% for the virtual exhibition and can be as high as 20% if you visit the fair in person.
The Tehran Book Fair provides a good opportunity for international visitors, book lovers, publishers, distributors, and retailers to meet and do business and at the same time exchange culture during the 10-day event. Salman Kujiri, Tehran.
Foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria, and Turkey agreed to prepare a roadmap for developing relations between Damascus and Ankara. Relations between Ankara and Damascus soured after the foreign-backed militancy broke out in Syria in 2011, when flows of Syrian refugees flooded Turkey. The safe and dignified return of Syrian refugees was one of the key principles for the Moscow talks.
It has been a key principle for all the countries present here to contribute to a safe and voluntary return of refugees and internally displaced persons to the places of their permanent residence in Syria, as well as to ensure their right to receive support. It appears important to start discussing the issue of restoring disrupted transport and logistics ties between neighboring countries and resuming trade and economic cooperation without any barriers.
The participants also discussed the U.S. measures in creating a so-called Free Syrian Army, which used ISIS militants and other terrorist organizations against Syria's legitimate authorities with the aim of destabilizing the situation in the country. Russian and Syrian militaries have recently discussed the issue, agreeing on a model of joint action in that regard. The sides also discussed illegitimate unilateral sanctions applied by the U.S. and its Western allies, which block the provision of international humanitarian assistance to Syria, including through the U.N. The head of the Russian Foreign Ministry drew attention to the fact that the U.N. humanitarian plan for the current year for Syria was funded by 8%, but the emergency appeal of the same U.N. to provide assistance in the territories not controlled by Damascus was immediately paid almost in full.
The talks in Moscow can be called historic. Iran and Russia paved the way for the negotiation process in Syria and made great efforts to ensure that this meeting took place. Moscow has demonstrated that its conditions are realistic. It was supported by Iran in this, which has done a lot to save the sovereignty of Syria. The meeting of the Syrian minister and his Turkish counterpart gives hope for the establishment of calm in the country. Turkey had to come to terms with the fact that Bashar al-Assad's power will remain. We have witnessed a reset in relations and what the collective West has been trying to prevent in every possible way.
The process of normalizing relations between Ankara and Damascus was launched on December 28, 2022 in Moscow, when first consultations were held between the heads of the defense ministries of Russia, Syria and Turkey. Earlier, President Erdogan invited President Putin to hold a trilateral meeting with the participation of the Syrian leader. This summit, according to him, should have been preceded by negotiations at the level of representatives of the special services, defense and foreign ministers.
The foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Turkey and Syria warned that their countries will not allow any external interference in regional affairs. They expressed readiness to boost their fight against terrorism, saying they will be in full swing to ensure security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
EU leaders are accused of failing the people of Sudan. The 27-nation bloc's weak foreign policy in Africa has allowed tensions to develop into chaos and carnage, according to some legislators in the European Parliament.
We must understand that hoping for the best is not sufficient. If we do not engage constructively and in a timely, effective manner, we will always need to run for cover when it is already too late.
It's the Rapid Support Forces versus the Sudanese Armed Forces. Rival generals, once allies, are battling it out.
The West were happy to legitimize the de facto military dictatorship,
because this is the arrangement that has served their financial interests and the interests of the IMF and the World Bank for many years.
In the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured. The situation in Darfur and other regions is also dire. When it comes to African nations, the West is accused by critics of only ever having been interested in pillaging natural resources, such as gold, diamonds and oil. At least 450,000 people have been forced to flee their homes in Sudan since war broke out on April 15th.
Let us not allow for a new tragedy, or at least do the utmost of our efforts. If the EU wants to live up to its values, this is the time to go for our limits.
Foreign powers are competing for influence in Sudan because of its position on the map. Apparently, the EU has taken its eye off the ball.
Don't make the mistake to only focus on the war in Ukraine. All kinds of leaders seize the opportunity because they see the European Union as a soft power entity.
The EU has opened its doors to millions of Ukrainian refugees. The bloc is being criticized for not providing safe routes for those escaping Sudan.
I hope that this will be a matter for the meeting of the Foreign Affairs Council, which takes place this weekend. It's currently not on the agenda. I would urge the Commission to try to address this.
Some commentators claim Washington is pouncing on the crisis with an aim of implementing ideological changes by removing Islam from Sudan's constitution. Once again, the US is accused of interference to try and further its own agenda. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On May 9th, Russia commemorates the capitulation of Nazi Germany to the Soviet Union and the 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians killed in the World War II, known in Russia as the Great Patriotic War. This year, the victory parade on Red Square in the heart of Russian capital Moscow was held without the usual aerial maneuvers and with a minimum of equipment. With the latest military developments in the Ukraine war, fighter jets, tanks and missile defense systems were partly showed, as they are needed today at the front line. In his Victory Day speech, President Vladimir Putin said that the real war is once again unleashed against Russia, but the country will ensure its security and protect the inhabitants of Donbas.
Boundless ambition, arrogance and impunity inevitably lead to tragedies. This is the reason for the catastrophe the Ukrainian people are going through. They have become hostage to the coup d'etat and the resulting criminal regime of its Western masters, collateral damage in the implementation of the cruel and self-serving plans.
Vladimir Putin also criticized the demolition of monuments to Soviet soldiers and said the West is creating a Nazi cult. The president pointed out that the desecration of a generation of victors is a crime.
It is a crime, an outright revanchism on the part of those who were cynically and blatantly preparing a new march on Russia and who brought together neo-Nazis come from around the world for this. Their goal, and there is nothing new about it, is to break apart and destroy our country, to make null and void the outcomes of World War II, to completely break down the system of global security and international law, to choke off any sovereign centers of development.
At 14, I became a partisan, then an infantryman machine gunner. This is our victory, and we have won this memory. We see the depressing example of Europe. I want to say that Russians will never forget this day and will always remember it. Here, it will always be honored.
I'm from Makeyevka, from Donbas. My entire mining family has perished since 2014. Only one son remained. And today, I've come here in Moscow to pay my debt to all the defenders, the soldiers of our past and present.
Unlike last year, the Russian president did not announce new measures to support the participants in the special military operation, but noted the leaders of the CIS countries who came to celebrate Victory Day in Moscow. Together with Putin, the leaders of Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan watched the parade on Red Square.
For millions of Russians, May the 9th is a lot more than a national celebration. Today, Russians celebrate their victory over the Nazis in 1945. The Russians are one of the last to celebrate this holiday officially, remember which side were the heroes and at what cost the Soviets got this victory. Марина Картунова, Moscow.
Israeli warplanes carried out a series of airstrikes at pre-dawn Tuesday, which resulted in the death of three high-profile military commanders of the Islamic Jihad movement, Tariq Izzeddin, Khalil al-Bahdini, and Jihad al-Ghanim. The Ministry of Health confirmed the death of 13 Palestinians altogether, including women and children, among them the wives and children of the Islamic Jihad commanders. 20 others were also injured, some of them in serious condition. The Israeli airstrikes, which targeted the middle of the Gaza city and Rafah and Khan Yunis in the southern of the coastal enclave, caused a great destruction of the residential apartment buildings as well.
I was asleep, and suddenly the explosion broke out and the rubble fell on us. My granddaughter was asleep by my side. We both woke up, not able to see anything from the destruction.
The Israeli occupation has a record in killing Palestinian civilians, children and women. Today, Maya Ezzeddin and Haja al-Bahdani, two Palestinian girls, the daughters of the Islamic Jihad leaders, fell victim to the Israeli attacks, like the other thousands of innocent children that were killed before.
Palestinian resistance movements have mourned the martyrs and the family members and condemned the Israeli assassination. In several statements released, they have warned the Israeli occupying regime of the scale and the scope of the Palestinian response to the crime.
The Israeli assassination of the Al-Quds Brigade's commanders is going to cost the Israeli occupation a heavy price. It is a legitimate right to fight the Israeli occupation, and it's the resistance's duty to defend the Palestinian people against any Israeli aggression.
The heinous atrocity of the Israeli occupation that resulted in the assassination of three senior leaders of the Islamic Jihad movement and other civilians will see the Palestinian resistance factions unite in their crushing response as usual. We have the right to resist the Israeli occupation as it continues to commit war crimes against our people.
Thousands of Palestinians carried the bodies of the martyrs from the hospital to the Grand Al-Umari Mosque and then to the final destination to bury them in the northern Gaza Strip. Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets to express their anger over the Israeli crime that resulted in the death of innocent women and children. Palestinians are now calling for retaliation. The Palestinian resistance factions are now preparing for a crushing response to the Israeli attack and the assassination of the Islamic Jihad commanders, affirming their unity against the regime. Ula Al-Asi, Gaza.
The fifth international exhibition of the export capabilities of Iran is underway at Tehran International Permanent Fairground from May 7th to 10th. The event aims to help companies export their products, develop new markets, and promote their industries while focusing on the importance of non-oil exports. One of the most successful contributors to Iran's non-oil revenues is the country's free industrial and trade zones, which accounted for one-third of the country's non-oil exports last year. During a press conference, the secretary of Iran's Free Zones High Council said 370 major investment projects are going to be executed in seven free trade zones across the country, and all investors are welcome to participate in these projects.
Our colleagues have conducted preliminary studies about investment in the seven free industrial and trade zones. Preliminary justification plans have been prepared, which shows that these projects are going to be profitable. Studies related to the market, land, energy, etc. have also been conducted.
There are seven active free zones in Iran, including Kish, Chabahar, Qeshm, Anzali, Aras, Arvand, and Maku. According to official statistics, the free zone's productions were about $1 billion last year. One of the most important free zones with lots of potential is the Chabahar free zone.
Chabahar Free Zone is located near the Mokran coastal region. Based on the description of the Islamic Republic of Iran's leader, this region is a hidden treasure in Iran. He has mentioned this several times. As the third energy hub of the country, petrochemical units are going to be opened in Chabahar. These units will begin production after 2 years, and their products will be ready to be introduced to the global market.
Free zones have helped the process of development of Iran through providing conditions that have attracted foreign investors.
Customs and transportation services are much better in the free zones. Also, there are better investment opportunities there. Aras Free Zone is one of the 7 free zones in Iran. This zone has been very successful in industrial activities as well as agriculture.
Officials say the development of projects in free zones is expected to attract a huge volume of investment valued at $5 billion to Iran's economy. The projects are also going to generate new employment opportunities for 23,000 job-seeking people at large.
Iran Expo 2023 has introduced hundreds of investment opportunities in the country's trade and industrial free zones. The free zones of Iran, as one of the important tools of development, play an important role in the prosperity of the national economy. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
In the limelight.
More Americans died of gun-related injuries in 2021 than in any other year on record, according to the latest available statistics from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. That included record numbers of both gun murders and gun suicides. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Recent international wrote in this regard, Texas is setting a new record for mass killings. A day after a gunman killed 8 people and injured 7 others north of Dallas, Texas, the driver of a Land Rover drove into a group of migrants waiting at a bus stop, killing 8 on Sunday, May 7th. 10 people were injured. The attack occurred in Brownsville, Texas, near the border with Mexico. The driver of the Land Rover, identified as George Alvarez, was initially charged with reckless driving, according to police. Also on Monday, May 8th morning, the police charged him with 8 counts of manslaughter. The police said they had not yet determined whether the act was intentional. Alvarez had a record that included prior charges of assault and driving while intoxicated, according to police. After the Brownsville killing, he tried to flee the scene, but witnesses held him until the police arrived. Police Chief Felix Sousa said at a news conference that the department was waiting results of former toxicology tests. Alvarez was not cooperating, the police said. In the mall shooting in Allen, Texas, the alleged gunman died after a confrontation with police at the Allen Premium Outlets, the scene of the shooting, Allen Police Department officials said on Saturday, May 6th. The hospitalized victims' ages ranges from 5 to 61 years old, authorities said. There was a surreal scene after the shooting. Shoppers at the Allen Premium Outlets were ordered to come out with their hands in the air, presumably to ensure nobody was carrying a weapon or was an accomplice in the shooting. After the latest massacre in Dallas, there was a string of vacuous statements from American officials. President Joe Biden called on Congress to pass an assault weapons ban following the Texas Mall mass shooting. Yesterday, an assailant in tactical gear armed with an AR-15-style assault weapon gunned down innocent people in a